It is precisely because we view ourselves as dedicated and committed people that we are likely, if we do not watch out, to suddenly get ourselves into a personal burnout trap. The committed worker tends to take on too much for too long and too intensely.
Welcome to the Thriveology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Neil Lutterbach, that's me.
And Phil Dunwoody, that's me. Neil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Before we get started, Neil, where can people find us?
Excellent question, Phil. Please subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and also LinkedIn. And you can reach out to us with questions or comments at thriveologylab@gmail.com.
All right, so today's topic is burnout and workplace well-being, and we're going to focus really a lot on the burnout side of that. This is something that really ever since the pandemic, you've been hearing about kind of quiet quitting and all and burnout and all these things. This has been in the news. Organizations have been talking about it. And it's not going away, right? The kind of Gallup collects research every year at on a global level on burnout. And this has become kind of an important, really worldwide issue about the quality of our work and as such, the quality of our lives. So we're going to talk a little bit about the history of burnout. Burnout, we're talking about it mainly in the workplace, though not exclusively. That's mainly where the literature has focused on. We're going to talk about how to spot burnout, how to address burnout, a little bit about burnouts in different fields because there are occupational differences. And then we're going to use that same term and some of the same concepts to talk about areas of personal life, specifically parenting. So let's start with, where does this term burnout come from?
Yeah, so as we were doing the prep the other day, trying to track, the idea seemed to be in the ether, perhaps in sort of drug culture and everywhere else, as sort of a burnout person. But the person to really use it clinically, as far as we can tell, the first time was Herbert Freudenberger, who is a clinical psychologist. And this is 1975. And he himself began feeling these symptoms of exhaustion, of disinterest with his work. And he noticed it in his clinical practice with other psychologists in his office, and he assigned the term then burnout to this. And what we have since realized, and what the literature we're going to cover, is that it's more pronounced in people who do work in emotionally demanding fields, but that's not exclusive, as you pointed out. But people who are drawn to emotional work, like parents, teachers, nurses, frontline workers, people who deal in sort of emotionality with their work, often are drawn to those efforts because of a deep need to help others. And while that's really noble, it can come as a great personal and sort of institutional cost if some of those circumstances aren't managed. And so some of the symptoms we're going to keep coming back to, this exhaustion, fatigue, emotional fatigue, but also there's a frequent propensity for illness or the inability to shake a cold. And if you are someone who's like, I'm kind of bummed out at work and I just keep getting sick, those could be really pronounced signs of burnout.
So I'm thinking about how, in part, how I first started talking about this literature myself. So I did basically a senior leadership development program, the year we started doing it was the year COVID hit. And so we're supposed to have these kind of in-person meetings and conferences, and instead it wound up all being online. And of course, that was the time we were all scrambling to figure out how to do our work and how to move our institutions online and set up policies around different things and masking and social distancing. And there was all this really added workload and stress. And so we were in this leadership development program, and we were supposed to kind of self-select into groups. And I wound up in a group of people. We were all supposed to pick in our groups a project to focus on. And I wound up in a group of people who said, are you freaking kidding me? I have no time. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to keep my head above water. I'm at my wit's end. I'm burnt out. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing a project. Basically, they were going rogue. Right? And so we tried to kind of spin that into a more positive direction and say, let's actually talk about workplace burnout and what it is and workplace well-being and what we can do to improve our situations. And then in the kind of leadership position I had at the time here at the college, in my role as associate provost, I was overseeing institutional surveys that were asking questions about burnout. And we saw again, of an upswing in burnout in education professionals across mm-hmm. the country, as well as other fields for sure, healthcare. But we were trying to deal with it institutionally. We saw it was impacting women more than men. And so I wound up giving workshops here on campus and elsewhere about workplace well-being and burnout because kind of like Freudenberger here, because I was wrestling with it mm-hmm. myself. And I was reading about it because I wanted to understand what's happening to me. I wanted to understand what's happening to my friends and my colleagues who I saw were clearly really, you know, something had changed in them. Something had changed in our workplace environment in a negative way. And I recognized it as an institutional risk and something that was affecting people that I care about and myself.
And I think what I hear in your story, what Freudenberger has a whole list of different kinds of people that may be more prone to experience burnout. But what I hear is sort of a both and. It's not that people do no longer care about what they are doing that causes the burnout. It's often that they care a great deal, but whatever resources that would have been, you specifically said, I don't have time for that. Mm-hmm. The time as a resource, or whether it's fiscal resources or physical resources or what have you, some resource prevents me from executing on that passion. And so this like burning out, like an engine just grinding, mm-hmm. and I can't move forward with that. He talks about sort of the overcommitted worker who has a lot of investment in their work but doesn't have a lot of outside life going on, some things beyond the work, so they over-identify with the work. We'll come back to that later. He calls another the authoritarian, who is a person who needs a great deal of control in their workspace, but maybe doesn't feel like they do. The administrator, who's trying to hold it all together, and they just can't seem to do it. And a variety. But what I think we hear is this both and, that there are things that the individual can do, and maybe some things they can't do, and some things that the institution could or should be doing as well.
Yeah, and I think this is really how our understanding of it has evolved and changed, in that, you know, if you look at a lot of what our HR programs do at most organizations, they're largely trying to address, not completely, but in many ways, like, let's say, wellness program. Mm-hmm. Those are addressing, to some extent, symptoms of burnout and not root causes, mm-hmm. right? And so leadership development programs that talk about the workplace environment, I mean, the literature makes very clear the cause is not individuals. the cause is the workplace environment. And we'll talk about some of those kind of specific factors. But, you know, the unrealistic work demands. If unrealistic work demands are being put on me, that's not something as an employee. It's not like I can just meditate and make them go away.
Right.
You know, meditating and exercise, all these things you and I have talked about through this podcast, sleep and nutrition, those will all help me cope with this stressful environment. But it's the chronically stressful environment that is causing the burnout. Mm-hmm. And if you want to actually address the root cause, you have to address it at the environment level.
That's been my I know we often sound like a broken record because when we're talking about sort of functional well-being, functional thriving, we're talking about getting at the root causes of those things, not just symptomatic, but like what's going on. Maybe it's nutrition. What's going on nutritionally at the root cause that's causing some physiological change? But so too here, you know, your workplace is a system. It's a system of behaviors, rules, guidelines, people's relationships, all expectations, all these sort of systematic things. And so like if we think of the the institution as a body, I'm not going to be able just to slap a Band-Aid or add a supplement to it. I need to get at some of the root causes of what's going on.
And those are hard because they're structural, and often they are even bigger than the organization, right? Because there are societal factors that our organizations are trying to cope with. So, yeah, it is. None of this is to say, of course, that this is easy. This has become such an issue that the World Health Organization now officially recognizes workplace well-being and burnout as an issue. So the World Health Organization, they have adopted Christina Maslach. She is a really just a superstar in the burnout research. Her inventory, the Maslach Burnout Inventory, has become the standard tool. The definition they use, World Health Organization, that is from her work. And I'm going to quote here, "Burnout is a syndrome conceptualized as resulting from chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. It is characterized by three dimensions, feelings of energy depletion or exhaustion, increased mental distance from one's job, reduced feelings of efficacy." Okay, and so those three things, and I think in the definition, it's what you and I were getting at, chronic stress. Mm-hmm. All of us can grind for a period and deal with, you know, essentially excessive work demands for a period. But when you have that chronically, then that is when it becomes problematic. The last episode or the one we did before that was on stress, right? And the impact of stress on your body. And we talked about some of the things, you know, your stress response is a survival response, right? So you have this flood of adrenaline and cortisol and different things in your body that are designed to provide your body with energy to address an immediate emergency. And your body gets that energy by sacrificing other systems that are designed to keep you alive and well long term. And so this immediate stress response it helps with short-term survival in an evolutionary environment, but actually causes long-term mortality, right? You have risk factors for chronic cardiovascular disease being the result of chronic stress. And you can think of burnout, as we're defining it here by the World Health Organization, is chronic stress in your workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And it has all the negative consequences that chronic stress in any environment would have.
And just as we talked about in that episode on stress, like even in the workplace, some of that acute stress can be a really potent tool to jumpstart work, get work done, have deadlines. Those are all like potent. And I think her, you know, that reduced professional efficacy is really important, that like what I am doing doesn't seem to matter. I don't seem to matter. I just like, it's one thing if I have a acute stress, I apply that stress, I get a thing done. I am rewarded or otherwise acknowledged for that. And then I can sort of go down and in that sort of parasympathetic way, recover. And then the next stressor. But if I keep grinding, I keep getting stressors added to my plate and nothing I do seems to matter, and I'm not being acknowledged for anything, that's a recipe for this burnout, for sure.
Yeah, the reduced professional efficacy. This comes with things like, you know, do I belong here? Mm-hmm. Am I in the right job? Maybe I should, you know, start looking for alternatives. Maybe I should get a job elsewhere. Do I want to switch industries? Do I want to switch companies? This isn't working for me. And often it's the question then is me. People will think there's something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
They may also become quite negative towards their employer. This is the second kind of category, was increased mental distance from one's job. But one way that can materialize is feelings of negativity or cynicism about one's job and one's employer. And then the first one we had mentioned was these feelings of energy depletion or exhaustion, right? So again, you have a really busy, hard day at work. It's totally fine to come home and feel depleted and exhausted. That's not necessarily a bad thing. If you chronically feel that way, that's when it becomes problematic, right? Because this means your body's stress response is active all the time. And then you're not feeling, you know, we've talked about the system, our own kind of well-being system, the Thrivology Lab system, right? And what I noticed when I was working too much, when going through that COVID period and I had a number of administrative roles, I was working late into the evening every night. I was working weekends. And what that meant was that I was not eating right because I didn't have time to cook. I was not exercising like I might normally. I was not sleeping well because of the basically that additional stress. One of the things your body does as part of the stress response is reduce your sleep cycle. Mm-hmm. And so all of those things then snowball into feeling burnout.
If I'm burnout, that then results in a poor quality of work that I'm doing. The work
yes.
that results in like poor quality for the institution, which gets, it's just a cycle back through, right? It just keeps cycling around. And what I also think, we keep talking about this feeling of burnout, but you have in the notes, maybe you can talk about this. It's not just a feeling. There are physiological effects of this.
It's chronic stress.
Right.
Right. And so this, again, this increase in certain hormones, cortisol in particular in your body, blood pressure increases, not sleeping, problems with digestion. All of those are kind of physiological responses to stress. And again, short term, no problem. Long term, then it's actually compromising your body. And this is why it matters for organizations. Big picture, this is not an individual issue. It's an organizational issue because it actually costs organizations a lot of money in increased healthcare costs, in employee turnover, in employee absences, employee disengagement. Organizations care a ton about those things. They pour lots of resources into them. Gallup is a really big organization that addresses a lot of this kind of at the survey level and also in some employee training that they do with organizations. They did a survey of 7,500 employees, and the top causes of burnout that they identified were unfair treatment at work, salary recognition and fairness concerns, unmanageable workload, lack of role clarity, like what exactly am I supposed to be doing, lack of communication and support from managers, and then unrealistic time pressure. And Christina Maslach's research, she talks about drivers of burnout, and it's a similar list, right? Workplace demands, lack of control, lack of appreciation, lack of community. This is a big one. If you feel like you have positive supports at work, social supports, we're social beings, and that really matters. And if you have particularly a negative relationship with your manager, whoever your supervisor is, that drives people away. It not only causes them to disengage from work, it causes them to leave that institution. And so this is where kind of the training for managers becomes so important.
Well, I've often said, just as a teacher for myself, that like you can't teach anybody anything. You can only create the conditions under which someone might learn. Mm-hmm. And I think that's similar to sort of my own beliefs about sort of workplace leadership. Like you can't lead anybody, you can only create the conditions where they can thrive and work. And if that's really the leader's job, is creating this environment where you can trust your people to do the work that you've hired them to do.
Right.
But so often we don't feel like that's the case, or maybe you feel like you're micromanaged. But this you brought this up at the beginning. There was a 2019 article in the Harvard Business Review written by Jennifer Moss. Burnout is about your workplace, not your people. And she talks about, here's a quote from her, "We tend to think about burnout as an individual problem solvable by learning to say no, more yoga, breathing techniques, practicing resilience." We will talk about that in a second.
All things I do, by the way. Wonderful thing.
But evidence is mounting, she writes, that applying personal Band-Aid solutions to an epic, rapidly evolving workplace phenomenon may be harming, not helping the battle. Leaders take note, she said, it's not about you. It's now on you to build a burnout strategy. And that's why I think that community that you're talking about, how do I cultivate community around this and a culture of this that's not just about leading, which I think tends to come out as sort of a top-down way that doesn't necessarily make people feel valuable.
No, it's more about inspiring them,
right?
Right? And talking about the institution's purpose Right, we've talked about meaning and purpose. Mm-hmm. We've had several episodes on that at the individual level. Well, the same thing is true of organizations. Mm-hmm. When you believe in the meaning and purpose of your organization and you clearly see where you fit into that, that is something that promotes workplace well-being and thriving, which is the opposite of burnout.
Mm-hmm. And right? When you see that, like when an organization doesn't communicate that and they, like, you have a sense of value and that those values, it's not the who, what, where, it's the why. Yeah. So why are we doing this? Why am I doing this for my own purpose? Why are we doing this as an institution? When I no longer feel that's alignment, it's going to that my values feel out of alignment with the institution or vice versa. That could also applies to that efficacy as well then.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think the what you were saying, you know, about the yoga and the mindfulness and the breathing, I think these can be good things to include in employee well-being programs, but the messaging has to be very clear. Mm-hmm. That, you know, if you're struggling at work, you want to avoid the thing like, oh, well, the problem is you, therefore mm-hmm. you just need to adopt these things and then you'll be okay.
Yeah.
Right? That's not like you said earlier, it's a both and, right? So yes, we do need to have positive coping skills. Those tools are very effective for dealing with stress. And at the same time, the organization has to acknowledge kind of its role and leadership's role in helping message that. I mean, mm-hmm. In my role here, like, I've talked a lot about burnout with other people in the administration, with my colleagues, so that it becomes an open topic and something that, you know, hopefully it's clear that we care about it and we're trying to address it mm-hmm. as an organization. It's challenging. So, and I mentioned, you know, big organizations are paying more and more attention to this because, you know, to some extent because of the bottom line, because it really is an institutional risk factor and it costs money. The research shows that, you know, for every dollar you put in to kind of employee well-being, wellness programs, you make money on them, essentially. It's not actually a cost, if you will. It's an investment. And that it also shows that if you look at organizations and the employee ratings of kind of well-being at their companies, that actually predicts future workplace performance of the organization. Essentially, the returns that the organization makes in the stock market, mm-hmm. right? So there was a 2023 study by researchers at Oxford and Harvard titled "Workplace Well-being and Firm Performance," and they found a clear link between current workplace well-being scores and future profits. So I'm going to quote here from the abstract: We use novel large-scale data from Indeed, a major job website, to assess the relationship between workplace well-being and firm performance. Our measure of employee well-being includes self-reported job satisfaction, purpose, happiness, and stress, which we aggregate to over 1,600 listed companies in the United States, using company-level employee well-being measures to predict firm performance. We find that well-being is associated with firm profitability and that companies with the highest levels of well-being also subsequently outperform standard benchmarks in the stock market. Overall, these descriptive results show a strong positive relationship between employee well-being and firm performance. So, and then there's all these costs that we also know related to kind of the opposite of that, burnout, right? When employees are struggling with burnout, that chronic stress, that system being activated long-term, you're going to have increased sick days, increased medical bills. Any pre-existing medical and physical mental and physical health issues you have will be exacerbated by that chronic stress. And so you're going to result with decreased employee productivity, mm-hmm. Quiet quitting, disengagement, and turnover. All those things are really, really costly.
And another Maslach references another component of that, which is this emotional contagion thing, that if you have somebody who's burnt out, that could easily spread. That sense of disinterest, of dissatisfaction spreads, and what is now one person can become now multiple people, and they can exacerbate pre-existing peripheral problems as well. She talks about a study that found that 90% of the subjects with severe burnout reported a physical or mental disease with musculoskeletal pain and depression as the most common problems. So it's not like this depression is causing other problems that, to your point, you know, then I'm taxing the insurance, my resources. I'm incurring more sick days. It just keeps – one problem becomes a much larger problem.
Yeah, and the emotional contagion part is huge. Mm-hmm. When you have an employee who's really struggling with burnout, often they're bitter about mm-hmm. their workplace and their job. And, you know, just like, you know, when you're around someone who is depressed for a period, it's hard not to get depressed yourself. Mm-hmm. You're around someone who's happy all the time. It's hard not to be happy. We emotions are contagious. This is a common kind of theme in psychology. And that's true in the workplace just as much. And so, yeah, the negative effects of burnout are not isolated to individuals. You can view them as spreading like a disease, which, again, this is why we want to actually prioritize it as something we address institutionally.
There was a 2022 Gallup survey. There's another Gallup survey looking at burnout rates by industry. And some of this was not surprising to me, and some of it is surprising to me. So perhaps not surprisingly, teachers, both at K through 12 and college and university, top the list as suffering the greatest burnout. That, again, we certainly saw that through the pandemic. But then below that, professional service, government and or public policy employees, retail, and then healthcare. I would have assumed, and maybe this changed in a later survey, healthcare wasn't higher. I'm surprised that that's not higher than that.
Yeah, no, that's and we do see – you know, burnout is an issue in healthcare for mm-hmm. sure. And I don't know how much those numbers change year to year. Mm-hmm. Like that's 1 year snapshot.
Yeah.
And it might have been particularly high because of COVID. But I would also have thought the same thing with healthcare. I mean, my wife is a nurse. She worked through COVID, and that was a very, very difficult time. Right. So we do see higher burnout in teachers and kind of other areas with this emotional labor.
Right. You know, part of the – and we see both with teachers and nurses, part of that, you know, that job is relational, and that a desire to care for the students or your patients this was a survey from 2020 with 500 teachers in Turkey reported that perceived organizational support, goal progress, and positive effects significantly and positively predicted the participating teachers' job satisfaction levels. In other words, like that environment, do I have the resources? Do I have the things I need? And that was, I think, you know, we experienced it as college professors during the pandemic when you feel like I can't deliver to my students what I think they need, and this sort of wrestling up against a wall leads to that. We certainly saw that with nurses. Here's a 2020 meta-analysis that it had 113 studies, including 45,000 nurses across 49 countries, and the main factor that contributed to the job of nursing was, not surprisingly, caring. And again, by and large, this is a noble pursuit. But when those nurses were not able to deliver that care because – and my sister is also – she now works for a public school, but she was a pediatric ER nurse. And she got out of that. She loved it. She's a passionate, very empathic person, and she loved her job. But – the bureaucracy, the hospital bureaucracy, was so Byzantine to her that she's like, I cannot do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And she got out of the hospital, went into like public school nursing. But I think that's not an uncommon response, that like the resources are not there, or the administration is directly preventing me from doing the job that I wanted to do.
Yeah, and you hear that from teachers too, right? Especially in public schools mm-hmm. today. The amount of control they have over their classrooms has really diminished. And so much more prescriptive, you know, where their institutions purchase these kind of online programs and the teacher is just there essentially pointing them to a screen. Mm-hmm. And it's not what many teachers thought they were going into. And it's not nearly as satisfying as they hoped it would be. So how do you reduce burnout at work? Okay. And again, I think you can really divide this into, you could talk about individual coping factors in terms of how do you help reduce burnout versus institutional factors that you may have influence over or you may not, depending on kind of your role in the organization. Things like mindfulness yoga that we already talked about, these things help address the causes. I mean, I'm sorry, the symptoms, not the causes. And so they can be good to help people manage, but you want to think about what kind of training you're giving leadership so that they understand the causes, right? Leaders need to understand the research on burnout, how to recognize it, and then have some kind of model. Gallup uses a model they call Focus Me, Free Me, Know Me.
I love this.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's based out of their research, you know, and as well as other research. And the model is pretty simple. Focus me on clear goals, free me from unnecessary stress, know my strengths and weaknesses, and help me spend more time doing things that focus on my strengths. Now, that last one is interesting because a lot of performance reviews historically focus on people's weaknesses. Mm-hmm. You know, you did this. Well, okay, let's talk about this problem. And I'm not saying you shouldn't do that, but there's a whole kind of area of strength-based leadership, they call it, that really argues that old approach is just not effective. So that what you actually want to do is look at people's strengths and weaknesses and try and use them where their strengths are. Mm-hmm. And because addressing their weaknesses, it just doesn't work very well. This is what the research is. They don't change.
And I hear this as both from sort of an organizational managerial perspective and a self perspective. I know, like, and you and I have talked about, like, times in our careers where we've said yes to things or we've pursued things that are either just not in line with our own strengths, or we just probably didn't even have the time for it, but we thought it was going to look good on paper. So we said yes, which drew us away from the things that really are our strengths or really are the things we want to do. And so, yes, it's both. I think depending on one's job and position and industry, you may or may not have that flexibility or freedom, but I know for myself, I need to be very careful about my yeses.
Yeah. I mean, yes and no. I mean, I've heard some people say those are the two most powerful words in the English language.
Yes and no.
Yeah, yes and no. And when you're asked about things, you know, to really, we often think of just like, oh, this is a good opportunity to look good on my resume. Does it really advance me? But that's different from thinking about kind of what are my values and goals at work, and does it move me toward those, right? Because there's lots of good opportunities.
Sure, yeah.
It may not actually align with what I want to do in the future, what I want to become. Mm-hmm. It's also true, I think, sometimes you don't know that without trying these things.
Sure.
So sometimes you try, you know, oh, yeah, sure, let me try this out. And then you're like, oh.
And where you are in your career, if you're just sort of starting out, you may feel right, perhaps rightfully so, that you've got to say yes to some more things until you sort of establish yourself. I have a dear friend who's started in academia and is, you know, feels like, he's constantly going to conferences, constantly doing this, constantly writing. It's like, you're going to burn out, my friend. But I think he feels like he has to because he's got to establish himself. Then he can sort of pull off the throttle a little bit.
Right. That makes sense. You know, and in the beginning, if you're new to a career too, it makes sense to sample different things, to try different things and see, what is a good fit for you because you may not know. But, you know, kind of back to this, what are things that reduce burnout. This was a really interesting one, a Gallup statistic. One meaningful conversation with employees per week makes a difference. So I'm going to quote here from employees who say their manager is always willing to listen to their work-related problems are 62% less likely to burn out. So that's a huge percentage. It also, I think, indicates something's structural about the organization that may just sound relational, like, oh, I'm willing to listen. But that assumes if I'm in management, I actually have time to listen, which depending on my workload as a manager, I may feel like, yeah, I care and I want it, but I have to get this done. And so it's both my willingness to be open and message to people that I care about their workplace well-being. I care about their pressure points, their stress points, and I want you to talk to me. But then I also need the actual capacity to do it.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, just as a call to administrators and managers, that listening has to be active. It can't just be like, I'm just going to passively, you know, we've all probably had the manager who sits on their phone and you're talking and they just don't seem to be there with you. You know, it's those little actions that actually tell someone how valuable they are or are not. Yeah, or can make them feel that
way. And I've talked about this before. I think attention, giving someone your attention is one of the greatest gifts you can give. Right? It shows that you care, that you're there, that you're actually fully present. And to me, that's a lot of my own mindfulness training is about that. Like how am I spending my attention and what signs am I sending to others with that? Another interesting thing that the research shows is that managers essentially never have a neutral role in burnout. They either cause it or they prevent it, which is pretty fascinating. It's not neutral. Training managers how to spot burnout, it's a little tough because a lot of the things that people experience, they might be hesitant to self-report, right? Because they want to look good to their employer. They want to look good to their supervisor. And they may feel insecure about saying, actually, I'm struggling with this. And this is where the messaging of the supervisor is very, very important to say, no, I actually want to know those things. I value you as an employee, you know, because you're a positive contribution to this organization. How can I help you do these things better? It's a hard message to send. I think it's an important one so that people actually feel open to sharing what it is they actually struggle with at work.
No free ads, but I'm a fan of Patagonia. I think both of us are. And there's a fantastic book by the founder, Yvon Chouinard, called Let My People Go Surfing, which is based on a company policy where they allow employees a lot of sort of what we might call job crafting. So you can say, like, when you're coming in, what your hours are, built around other hobbies and passions, so surfing or hiking or sailing or whatever it is. I mean, they're an outdoorsy company, so they're often, you know, promoting sort of outdoorsy because they want them to be fully realized people, humans. They want them to explore their passions and curiosities, and you know, so they can adjust their workload. And what you see, I had a friend who worked for Patagonia, now works for REI. They are exceedingly loyal, the employees. They feel like this is a family. And he has a quote, and I think it requires a little unpacking, but he says, we need to blur the distinction between work and play and family. And I like that because, you know, if we think about this sort of work as a sort of hunter-gatherer tribal aspect, work was just sort of part of the whole experience. It was you had a clear purpose, you had clear feedback, right? And work was part of this sort of family experience. And it's not like employees just sort of shut off their family lives when they come to work. All of it is sort of in the mix of a human experience. So how can we support that? And I think they've found a really great way to do that. And of course, you know, it comes out in the number. I don't know what their stock price is these days, but probably pretty decent.
I think this gets at to something that's really important, which is the intentionality of workplace well-being models, and it's not something that happens by accident,
right?
So if you're just addressing it as a deficit thing, like, oh, people are disengaging, we have a burnout problem, it's important to recognize that, but you should actually be trying to build a culture of thriving where people feel like they have a sense of meaning and purpose at work, right? They have you mentioned it, the loyalty that results in that. When you need people to go the distance, then they're willing to. You don't want to just view it as, when I'm sick, I should go to the doctor. When I'm not sick, I don't need to worry about my well-being. No, it needs to be an intentional focus on well-being in a workplace, just as you and I, this whole, obviously, podcast is about the intentional focus on human thriving.
And Chouinard has this quote from the book, from Let My People Go Surfing. It says, "It seems to me if there is an answer, it lies in these words, restraint, quality, and simplicity. We have to get away from thinking that all growth is good. There's a big difference between growing fatter and growing stronger. Here again, less but better." Like, yeah. You know, you talked about, like, if maybe the administrator feels like they don't have time or they've got too much on their plate to listen to their employees, there's probably that is a problem, right? We need to, like, cut something so that we can focus on what actually matters as an employee, as an institution, so that the quality of our work is better, not necessarily more.
Yeah, I think that's that clarity of purpose, right? That you need as an individual, but you also need as an organization. The good news for people in leadership who are interested in this, even if your organization doesn't do these things, you can look – there are a lot of resources online, and you can kind of be a change agent in your own organization. Department of Health and Human Services actually has a model of workplace well-being. I don't know for how long, given the way our government's being deconstructed, but you can go download it at least today. But there are others that, you know, that this is, you know, that basically there's a lot of research already out there. I teach a class in organizational psychology where we cover a lot of this. And of course, I'm happy to come do a workshop at your organization as well if you want to reach out to us. All right. We've been talking about burnout as something in the workplace. And that is where most of the literature is and where most of the terminology has focused on. But you can talk about burnout in caretakers, caregivers, you know, someone you might be caring for, someone who's got some, they might be dying, right? Or some chronic health condition, parents. So you can view those also as chronic stressors, and you actually see some of the same issues in terms of mental distance from your role as a parent. The stress that comes with it. I mean, I have two boys now. I mean, they're not boys anymore. They're men, right? but I certainly remember, you know, when my wife and I, that feeling that both of us didn't, we felt like we didn't have enough time. Mm-hmm. Like we're working, the kids are putting demands on us. We love spending time with our kids, but it was almost like there's just no downtime because you get off of work and then you go home and the task demands mm-hmm. right. There are times, of course, playing with your kids really doesn't feel like work, and there are other times where, like, damn it, brush your teeth, like, how many times do I have to ask you? and it's stressful, and so you see these same issues. There's some research on this. There's a 2022 study, Child-Oriented Perfectionism and Parental Burnout, The Moderating Role of Parents' Emotional Intelligence. This is from 2022. I'm going to quote here, parent burnout is an overwhelming exhaustion related to their parental role, emotional distance from their children, a loss of parental fulfillment, and a perceived contrast between what they used to feel in the past and how they feel about parenting today. And they estimate about 5% of parents might suffer from this. And it's interesting, parents who prioritize external markers of success were more likely to experience burnout compared to those who are really focused on what they call pro-social accomplishments. So external measures of success, the issue there is then really feeling like your child isn't living up to them. Mm-hmm. And then another study, 2023, is risk factors and consequences of parental burnout, role of early maladaptive schemas and emotion-focused coping. Similar thing, these high standards, and you feel like your child isn't meeting them. And then what happens is you may be focused on the negative consequences of it, right? So, my child needs to become a professional athlete or go to this great college, and that means in kindergarten they must be killing it in everything mm-hmm. they do, because otherwise they're never going to make it to the Olympics, right? And that tends to make the children unhappy. It tends to make the parents unhappy. It's a risk factor for burnout.
And one of the things, it's not about not setting high standards.
Right.
Like, you can absolutely set high standards for children. This is true for our students as well. But, also allowing them to explore how they pursue that that standard and having fun along the way. I mean, we see this in the classroom as well. Like if the classroom isn't fun, if the house isn't sort of fun, I'm not going to grow and learn from this.
And I think that's why a lot of kids leave sports.
Right,
is
right.
Because it gets – in the beginning, it's fun. And then it quickly gets to a competitive point, often at a very young age, mm-hmm. where it's not fun anymore.
And it's not even about the kids. It's about really the parents and what the parents want, not even what the kid wants. It's not that he's feeling – the kid is feeling these external pressures.
Yeah, I mean when I think about my own children's education – one of the things I wanted them most to get out of school as young children was the joy of learning. Mm-hmm. And I can't say that they got that. Mm-hmm. You know, they often felt the school environment as oppressive and mm-hmm. top down and kind of authoritarian. Not always, but I think a little too often. And that doesn't promote flourishing and this kind of creativity. Right. And it instead can drive people away.
Okay, so you know we talked about this. What can institutions do? But what can you do if you're feeling this this pressure? Maybe you're in burnout. Maybe you're in some sort of pre-burnout. I'll say for myself, and here I know you have a story, Phil, about your mom. Like I need to set very clear boundaries for myself. I need to, as much as I'm focusing on the development of my work life, I need to have something going on outside of my work life that I also enjoy. So it's not just, I don't overly identify with the work. But you have a story about your mom. Too,
yeah,
about
just
boundaries.
Briefly. I mean, I remember at one point my mom was really feeling chronically stressed at work. And, you know, they were reducing the number of people that worked in her department and kept giving her more work. And then there were individuals that essentially weren't doing their work. And so then she was getting their work. And she had been kind of, you know, rightly complaining about this for a bit and how stressful her job was. And she was staying late and working through lunch and different things like that. And I said, well, are you, you know, have you talked to your boss about it? And she's like, yes, it doesn't matter. And I said, like, are you getting all the work done? And she said, yes. And I said, well, as far as they're concerned, there's no problem there. Mm-hmm. You know, she was at that time a state employee where you're supposed to have kind of pretty clear boundaries about when you come in and when you leave and kind of what breaks you get. And I encouraged her. I said, communicate with your boss, prioritize what you can actually get done in the time that you're supposed to be there getting paid for. And then just communicate with your boss clearly the things that you're not able to do because of the number of things on your plate. And I think that helped her kind of liberating. And I've had conversations with my boss about that as well. And like you, I had to learn the hard way to set clear boundaries, because as my workload increased, you know, I'm a hard worker. I want to do a good job. I want, you know, I'm also a people pleaser. I'm committed. I love where I work. So I wanted to go above and beyond and do all these things, but it was having a negative impact on me, mm-hmm. right? Because I was working late into every evening. It was pulling me away from my family. I wasn't sleeping as well. I wasn't eating as well. I mentioned many of these things already. And then I started to actually get a little bit bitter about my job. I was struggling with a job I had always loved, right? And I had to kind of step back and say, like, okay, I need to think about boundaries here. There's a lot I still love about my job, but I need to change my relationship with work. And, you know, this phrase quiet quitting can get a lot of bad press. But I think it depends on what you mean by quiet quitting, right? Because the term is used very loosely. If you're doing the bare minimum to not get fired, that's not thriving at work, right? That's not workplace well-being. But if what you mean by that is that you're not always going to go above and beyond, you're actually going to dial it back to put boundaries and have a better work-life balance, that's probably actually a good thing.
And, you know, if it's framed, like, I think what I also heard in your story is, like, I want to do a good job. Like, mm-hmm. I want the quality of the work to be really exemplary. And it's counterproductive for me to take on a bunch of different stuff to that goal. And so, like, it's not, this isn't like I'm just saying no or complaining just to, like, not do more work. It's that I really want to invest in a few clear objectives such that that quality represents my true self.
That's so true. I mean, no one feels fulfilled doing a crappy job on things, right? And it's, I had a very, to your point, I had a very clear conversation with my supervisor at one point in one of my reviews, and I was asked, you know, what do you want? And I said, I want to be good at my job. And I don't feel like I can be given the number of things I'm trying to manage, and that and it's deeply dissatisfying. You know, I wanted to limit or have more of a support team that I could delegate something, some structural change to allow me to feel like I was actually doing quality work.
And here's another. So Christina Maslach has sort of three recommendations for what you can do: focus on job, person fit, holistic approach, and restoration. And I think, you know, what we could say, like, if you feel like it's always the question of, like, when do I quit? When do I say enough is enough? Whether that's a relationship or a relationship with work. Like, if you've done all these things and it's still not a fit for you, like, it's not in alignment with your values, you can't seem to work around it, it might be a time to move on to something else, to find a different situation. So, I mean, I think about that as a relationship. How do you know when the relationship is truly no longer working? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah,
it's hard.
It's hard. It's multifaceted.
Right. But it might be an option to consider as well. I often think, like, for myself, stress is a signal that something needs fixed. And so if I'm feeling that, if you're feeling that workplace, chronic stress, not the acute, but if you're feeling chronically stressed, that is an important signal from your system saying, fix this. And if you've done all this, you've talked to the, you've put the boundaries on, and it's still not better, maybe it's not the right fit.
Yeah. And then the second thing that Maslach lists is basically a holistic approach that addresses organizational and individual interventions to address burnout. And this is, we've been talking about this throughout, right? So the organizationally, like, have conversations with your supervisor. Hopefully you have that kind of relationship where you can about your workload and your stress points. If you are in a leadership role, you know, what can you do to kind of support employees? What can those above you do to support you? And then back, you know, what can you do to set boundaries on your work life? I like this phrase of kind of transition zones. This is something I had to really think about. What I found when I worked too late into the evening is that I would wake up dreaming about work. And I wasn't sleeping very well.
Yeah.
And that I really needed 3 hours before bed to just completely detach from work. And, you know, I might exercise during that time. I might cook. I might play music, whatever. I might watch TV. I'm watching Severance right now, which is
really
pretty
good.
Interesting. you know, but whatever it is, but having kind of clear transition zones so that you're, you know, the last thing someone I work with who I respect a lot, but also I know has burned out in some of their roles. They mentioned at one point to me that the last thing they did before they went to bed and the first thing they did in the morning was check their work email. And I thought, like, where are your transition zones? Where are your boundaries then? And again, it's not because I don't care about my job. It's the opposite. I want to be able to show up and give myself fully to my workplace when I'm there and you know, be a positive contributor and you know, all those things. That requires me thinking clearly about boundary and transition zones.
And what I also hear in that transition zones is what I think Maslach's referring to as sort of restoration, like doing those transition zones, doing things that are restorative to you, whether that's cooking or playing music or exercise or going for a walk or playing board games with your friends, something that restores your energy, restores your mental and physical reserves.
Well, that's Maslach's third. That's the third point, right?
Yep.
It's restoration, focusing on things that And this is for the weekend. Right. Weekends, well, depending on your, of course, work schedule, that may or may not be when you're. But yeah, having again that break, that distance from work where you can focus on hobbies, you could do things that are just intrinsically motivating. Then you come back to work feeling renewed. You need that respite.
Mm-hmm. Challenge this week?
Are you? God. Your challenge is to not be burnt out. How about that? I think the challenge this week is to think about what do you control where you can address this? Because there may be aspects of your work schedule that you can control. In terms of your calendar, for example, how much of your work calendar do you have control of and when you do different things? Thinking about your transitions, your zones. And so I'd say thinking about burnout at this holistic level, what can you do at work? And then also what can you do at work that addresses hopefully some of the structural issues? And then what can you do as an individual to help you cope better with basically down-regulate that stress response, which I'd say, well, the good place to start would be to listen to all the Thriveology Lab podcasts, because that's basically what we've been talking about.
And I would say, you piqued my interest there a little bit. Like, if you are someone who does not keep a calendar, you brought how can I fix my calendar? Like, I find keeping a calendar is a really good sort of visual sort of reference point for me that I can see where the boundaries are. And because I think if without it, and I give my calendar a great deal of autonomy over my life, that like when this thing happens, it has to happen because it's on my calendar. And when it's not, I try to be very careful about things drifting into other things.
It's a good, one of the ways in which my calendar use has evolved is that my calendar at one point was just filling up chronically with meetings.
Yep.
And that other people would put on there, which is fine. That's part of my job. I don't mind that. But then I found myself unable to do, when do I get the things done that we're talking about in the meetings? Well, that was all getting pushed into the evenings and the weekends.
Right.
And so what I then had to evolve my calendar into was, okay, I go to a meeting. There's a thing I need to do. Let me look at my calendar and pick a time this week or next week, whenever it is, and actually block out time to do that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an important change for me because it meant I could actually do more of my job at my job instead of trying to fit it in at home on nights and weekends.
And I just as a teacher, I'm finding the same for students. Like if I can help them do the happier and healthier they seem to be as well.
Yeah. If you have a paper due on Friday, okay, when do you have blank spots in your schedule next week that you can work on it? Put it on your calendar.
Put it on your calendar. Yep.
Yep. And actually block that out. So that's very helpful.
Okay. That is it for this episode. Please subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube and we will be sure to respond. And please follow us on Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn. And if you have questions or comments or there's a subject you'd like to hear us discuss, please reach out to thriveologylab@gmail.com. Thrive on, friends.
Thrive on.